I had this teacher, so I'm a freshman in high school, and I might have been 14, whatever the age is. And I'm walking through the hallway, and this teacher is like an admin of some kind, walks out of his office, and he's like, son. And I was like, I'm like, you're just in trouble. What am I going to do? And he's like, you work out? And I was like, no. He's like, why not? And I was like, I don't know how. He's like, I'll show you. He's like, you got the genes. And so that teacher, Mr. Givens, ended up working out with me every day in high school and showed me how to work out. And he probably saw on some level that I was some angsty teenager that felt angry about whatever. And I, during our workout sessions, would be like, this guy said this to me, like, or like this boy, whatever. And I was like, man, I'm going to come back at our 10-year reunion. And I was like, I'm going to show him. I was like, he's going to be working for me, like blah, 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 right? And he's like, no, he's not. And I was like, what do you mean? I was like, let me just have my moment. Right? He's like, no, he's not. He's like, and you're not going to do that. Not if I have anything to say about it when you come back for the 10-year reunion. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, because if you come back at a 10-year reunion and say, hey, John, like everything I have, look at me now. He's like, the guy's going to laugh and be like, you did all of this to try and prove me wrong? Man, I feel sorry for you. And when he said that, when he actually played out what my like revenge fantasy was in real life, I realized it looked stupid.
Petty.
Yeah. I looked like the beta in the fucking situation, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so he was like, the only thing that you can do is win so big that all of them constantly compare themselves to you, and then you'll forget they exist. And that's when he said, success is the only revenge. He's like, it's not the best revenge. He's like, it's the only one. There's no other revenge.
Have I ever told you my idea of the lonely chapter? I told you about this?
No, but I feel like I've had a few of those.
Yeah. So I learned this with Alex Hormozy last year. And the lonely chapter describes a time in which you're growing, you're changing as a person, and you're now so different that you can no longer resonate with your old set of friends, but you're not sufficiently developed that you've got the new set of friends that you're going to grow into. And this is the lonely chapter. And the problem with it is that you're always, the desire to sort of regress back to where you were is always going to be there. And you're going to have uncertainty. Mm. There's not even the promise of glory or success or triumph when you get through the other side. What am I pushing toward? You know, I you're telling me that I'm not going to go out on this night out with my friends, which I've done for the last 5 years or 10 years in the town that I grew up in or went to university in or whatever. You're telling me that I'm not going to do that because I'm going to get up and I'm going to meditate or read. Who even knows if meditation works, right? Like, or you've got all of these questions in your mind and all of your friends and all of the dynamics and the temptations pull you back toward that. It pulls you back toward the old version of life. So this lonely chapter is a period through which I think everybody needs to squeeze. Anybody that decides to go from a place they are to a place that they want to be is going to have to let go of people who can't go there with them. And this isn't a value judgment about the people that are doing the personal growth thing are better than the people that are already fine as they are and are happy leading a different sort of life. It's that if you know that there is something that you're meant to do, if you know that there's something that you're meant to change, you will have to let certain groups, friends, routines, places, activities, recreations that you do, you're going to have to let those go. And there is this, you know, the Rocky cutscene lasts for 90 seconds in the movie, but it can last for 5 years in your life. And you have no idea whether or not it's even going to work. And that's the bit that always got to me. The bit that always got to me was I didn't even know if there was going to be any glory on the other side. It's like ordering an Uber and never knowing if it's going to arrive or not. And you think, well, I'm just stood here doing the thing, but I don't know if it's going to come out on the other side. And I can promise you, anybody that has done anything, moved from any place they were to any place that they want to be, has gone through this lonely chapter.
The amount of times when I was on my lonely path, where I was too different from the friends that I had, but not successful enough to be friends with the people that I wanted to be friends with, that's when you want people to root for you. That's when you want people to support you. Once you've already won, people are like, he's amazing, he's so good. But like, that's the time when you need it the least. And so you always have to be the person who roots for you before everyone else does. And it's usually a single clap in the auditorium for a very long period of time. It is a slow clap that's just you rooting for you. And that visual, I think, is one that you can kind of take, because it is... people struggle to do things alone. And the path of the exceptional person is one of an exception, which means that you are not with other people. And rather than fighting that or bemoaning it, see it as an indicator that you're on the right path. Because if everyone else were cheering you on, then it means you're not in the right place, because it means you're just like everyone else, and that's not where you want to be.
People only root for others at two times. First, when they're at the beginning of the race. Second, when they finish. Neither is when you need it. So you have to master the middle. The boring, exhausting, soul-crushing middle. That's where the winning happens, on your own. People will only cheer for you as long as you can't beat them at the game they value most. Friendly reminder that every person who doubts you is right until they aren't. It's a bug, not a feature.
Man, I feel like as you read these, you're reading my soul from this year. I tweet these every day as they come up, because that's what's top of mind for me. And, you know, the boring, mundane middle, like I think about, you know, the very, very beginning, people say, you know, I'm really excited for you that you're trying this thing out, right? And I noticed that everyone was very happy for me to try, because I temporarily decreased my status. I actually became worse than them during that period of time. And then as soon as I achieved a level of success, which I then realized that their happiness for me was proportional to where they were on the ladder relative to me. And so as soon as I passed some people, then they stopped being happy, and then they start, saying bad things.
Reminder that if you want to be exceptional, you're going to be different from everyone else. That's what makes you exceptional. You can't fit in and also be exceptional. Both have discomfort. When you fit in, you have internal conflict because you're not being 100% you. When you're exceptional, you have external conflict because everyone sees you as different. Pick one. When your friends start to say, you've changed, remember it's because they don't know how to say, you've grown.
I think most people have the potential to be exceptional, and because most people are peculiar in their own way. They just stifle that because they want to be accepted by most people, but in so doing, never accomplish what they want to do because they conform. If there's probably a lot of things about the world or even your world around you that you're like, this never made sense to me, but then you do it anyways. And I think that a lot of innovation and a lot of what makes people exceptional is feeling, you know, thinking that thought or seeing that thing and then being like, huh, I don't think I'm going to follow that rule anymore.
If they don't have what you want, don't listen to what they say. There's no greater waste of time than justifying your actions to people who have a life you don't want.
It's like the best way to guarantee to not have the life that you want is to do what everyone else is doing. Unless you want what everyone else has, which no one does.
Yeah, it's being able to think for yourself and treating it like a muscle, I think, is a smart way to consider it, because in the beginning, it's really, really hard. Totally. You've been resting on societal norms and the way you've dealt with past trauma and your parents' expectations and what all of your friends do and what's accepted and all of this stuff for so long that when it first comes to you needing to step on that muscle, it's like trying to move your ears. Like, all humans have got muscles that can move their ears, but because no one works it as a child, they just atrophy away. And this is the ear muscle of personal growth.
The fear that people have when they're starting out is that they say things like, I have nothing going for me. I have no advantages. I have nothing to my name. I have no money. I have no network. I have no resources. But using Rory Sutherland's reframing, it also means that you have nothing to lose, which makes you incredibly dangerous. And I think people wildly underestimate how many shots on goal you can take when you have nothing to lose. Whereas when someone has something to lose, they have to be more and more selective about the shots they take. And so you have the perfect conditions for taking risk, because the worst case scenario is baseline, is where you're currently at.
Correct. Yeah.
And so that
your
means,
downside is this.
Which means that it's like going to the casino and playing craps, but they say that you can just keep playing until you win. But people are afraid to roll.
You're going to lose sleep. You'll doubt whether it'll work. You'll stress to make ends meet. You won't finish your to-do list. You'll wonder whether you made the right call and have no way to know for years. This is what hard feels like, and that's okay. Everything worth doing is hard, and the more worth doing it is, the harder it is. The greater the payoff, the greater the hardship. If it's hard, good. It means no one else will do it. More for you.
I just cracked one day, and I was like, fuck happiness. Because it felt so out of reach that I was like, just fuck it. I'm not even gonna shoot for it. I'm just gonna do stuff. And that's all I'm gonna do. I'm just going to do stuff. That I had been trying really hard to beat. I mean, you'll notice a common theme with a lot of my stories, but I have one central person that I was trying to prove for a very long time, which is my father. And we're on good terms, by the way, because I always get that question. But this was after I left, and he disapproved of my whole thing. And for 5 years, we didn't talk very much. And so he calls me up he says, hey, you're going to want to sit down for this. And I'm like, okay, what? Are you pregnant? You know? and so he says, I'm sorry. And I was like, for what? And he was like, for everything. Right? Now, mind you, like, this is a Middle Eastern father born in Iran to a Middle Eastern father there who was even more legit. Like, where my father was born, women weren't allowed to drive cars. Cars came with drivers with them when you bought them. The driver came with the car.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Like, he was born in a very different world. Like, fathers don't apologize to sons. It just wasn't that way. And I have a little bit more awareness than I did then, and I can see that now. But for me, I was like, now you apologize? You know what I mean? And so rather than take it for the olive branch that it was, I said, I didn't care about your opinion 5 years ago when I left. And I was like, and I don't care now. And he was like, well, we'll see how long your success lasts. And so what could have been a really nice exchange ended up becoming pretty ugly. But the main point there was that I wanted to, in the beginning, like, make as much as my father. Then it was make more than my father. And then it was make more than my father had ever made in his entire life. And once I had achieved that, I realized that as much as, like, it sounds terrible to say this, but, like, I was trying to beat him at his game. And this is pretty alive in a lot of Asian cultures. Same thing. Making money is a big, you know, like, when my dad would introduce somebody, he'd be like, this is so-and-so. He makes this much a year. Like, it was just really clear, like, this is how much status someone has. And so, like, it was really deep for me. But it was only when I realized that I had won at his game that I realized I'd never even asked the question of, like, what game am I trying to win? And I don't know how many people are actually trying to win at a game that they didn't even set the rules up for.
So many.
When they're in it. And that's why I say, like, I think I was fortunate that I, you know, I hit a really tough goal, because my dad is a successful man, relatively early on. But that exchange, and then reflecting back and feeling terrible about myself for, like, saying what I said. And then I was like, I did everything that I've done to this point to beat him, beat my father, the man who actually raised me, who tried to make me the best man I can. And when I really start thinking about it, I'm like, I like who I am. He raised me. So doesn't that mean that he might have been the perfect father? And then that really messes with me. And so, yeah, so go ahead.
Well, it's hard to think that the people you used to have contempt for or distaste or hatred or whatever shaped you in a way that you couldn't have been. And I often think about how the things I'm most proud of in myself are the light side of something that I was so embarrassed about, yeah, so ashamed about. You know, being an outcast as a kid meant that I love or I'm capable of being on my own way beyond how anybody else is.
Yeah.
So far beyond it. I can work on my own in solitude for an endless amount of time. I can outwork anybody in solitude. Why? Because I spent almost all of my time between the ages of 6 and 16 in my bedroom listening to audio tapes. Right? Listening to audiobooks and like throwing like a tennis ball against the wall, or like playing with my like fucking Mighty Mouse from Mars or whatever they were called. What was it called? Biker Mice from Mars. That was it. And that was what I did.
Yeah.
So, but all of that discomfort and all of the challenges that I went through there are the thing, one of the things that I'm so proud of myself for now. Okay, so what if I look back and I said, well, the bullying that I went through and the challenges of feeling alone and being on the outside of social groups meant that I developed such attenuation and attention and focus and an ability to distill down what's happening socially, which is why I became one of the best club promoters in the UK for a decade and a half.
Right.
Because for all of my school life, I'd been obsessing over how Alex wears his tie. Maybe that's why he has friends and I don't have friends. Or the particular brand of shoes that he's wearing. Or the like he carries his bag on that shoulder and I carry mine on this shoulder. Because I couldn't deconstruct why I didn't have friends and everybody else did.
Right.
Okay, so looking back, would I have rather had the friends and had the brother or sister and not developed this skill? I can't split test life, so I don't know.
Right.
But my life's ended up pretty good, and I'm happy with it. So I need to not only look back at that stuff as something not to hate, but something to genuinely be thankful for. Yeah. And that is, frankly, something I'm still working through.
That the world belongs to those who can continue to work without seeing the result of their work. Continue to do without seeing the result of their doing. And it's really the person who can do that for the longest period of time. And that's usually because they're still getting leading indicators. It's just that it's amounting to a much bigger mountain. And so like, if you want to do big shit, it takes a way longer period of time, because the easy shit, the little hills, everyone conquers really quickly. I'm on time. I say please and thank you. It's like, so fucking what? And so like, if you want to do something that most people can't do, literally just extend the time horizon on the things that most people can't weather. Like, there's so much opportunity on the other side of being willing to persist for an extended period of time on the correct path without getting positive reinforcement from your environment.
In James Clear's Atomic Habits, I think he interviews maybe the Chinese weightlifting team's head coach, and he asked, what is the difference between the absolute elite world champions and the ones that simply qualify? And the coach said, the absolute elite are the ones who can continue to come in every single day without getting bored. That was it.
It doesn't matter whether I achieve all of my goals or I don't achieve all of the goals. In 3 generations, I'll be forgotten, and the only people who were naysaying against me will also be dead. And so then it's like, just do it for me. And then when I wake up every day, there's only one voice I have to listen to.
But that means that you need to be able to work out what to do from first principles. You now no longer have societal norms or assistance or role models or archetypes or expectations. And that's also difficult in a different way.
I think that the more you flex whatever that muscle is of like independent thinking, the more it becomes the default way that you think. And then everyone else's action is to start looking more and more insane to you.
What like? What's an example of that that you can think of?
I mean, shoot, just the most basic ones of like living the life that you don't want, not wearing what you want to wear, not dating who you want to date, not living where you want to live. Like, you're living at home and you want to move and your parents say no and you don't make the move, or you're dating a girl because she's socially accepted, you know, by your friend group, she's safe, but like there's always some distance in between you, but you're like, I don't want to risk it, right? Or like you're in the job and every day you go there and you're like, I mean, it's okay. And the idea of just living an okay life just sounds so terrifying to me, that the freedom to fail over and over again is still more fulfilling to me. At least it feels like it's real than walking through kind of on autopilot.
A friendly reminder that in 3 generations, everyone who knew us will be dead, including the people whose opinions stopped you from doing what you wanted all along. Imagine that someone you know achieves every dream and hits every goal they have. Years later, they get old and die. 2 years after that, how much do you care? about as much as everyone else will if you accomplish your goals and dreams. Do it for you.
I'd say one of the strongest mental frames that has gotten me through my hardest times is thinking this will be the story that I will one day tell. And that means the harder it is, the bigger the dragon, the more epic the story, and by consequence, the more epic the hero. And if you think about the difference between winners and losers, winners define themselves by what they made happen, and losers define themselves by what happened to them. And the difficult part of the lonely chapter is that the Rocky cutscene lasts 90 seconds in the movie and lasts 5 years in reality. And you won't die. And if you do die, you won't care because you'll be dead. And so, best case, you win. Worst case, it won't matter.